Launched in 2020 as a resource for teachers navigating the COVID-19 pandemic, Teachers in the Tiny Chairs is a podcast about all things early childhood teaching. I'm Dr. Christine Lippard, and each episode I interview researchers, classroom teachers, or other early childhood practitioners on a specific early childhood education topic. Intended to provide research background, practical ideas, and cheering on from a distance, Teachers in the Tiny Chairs is the long-distance mentoring your teacher prep faculty wish they could provide.
In this episode, I get to hang out with two of my preschool teacher pals, Kara and Haley, and hear about their experiences this year.
My name is Kara. I am currently teaching a mixed age group of 3 to 6 year olds, so I've got preschool and kindergarten. I'm working at a nature-based charter program. It's a public charter in Indiana. And so we have some influences from Montessori and Waldorf, but our big key piece is that we are outdoors in the forest, spending lots of time out in nature. This is actually my first year back into the classroom. I taught for a few years, more than a decade ago, but then I've spent the past 12 to 14 years working in coaching and workforce development and statewide systems and kind of looking at things from that macro lens across the state. And now this year I jumped back into the classroom again.
I'm Haley. I am a 4-year-old unified preschool teacher in a public school district in Iowa. And this is my second year teaching.
So I wanted to do a teacher panel and hear from teachers. One, because I haven't had as many teachers involved this second season in an effort to not overburden teachers. But thanks, guys, for your time. So now, feeling like what we're seeing in popular press and even research is sort of this idea of teacher burnout or teachers leaving the field, but it's hard to tell, like, is it as bad as we're hearing? Is it worse? Is it better? So you both come from a strengths-based perspective, and I'm totally starting with a deficit question, but we will get to strengths-based. So tell me about, like, how are you doing this year? How are your coworkers doing this year? Like, how are things going for teachers?
Well, I can jump in first. I'll start by saying, though, that my situation is pretty unique in that our school just opened. This is the first year. And so all of the teaching staff, all of the administrative staff, we're all jumping in with, this is our dream school, right? We're building it right now. And so we are finding ways to make it everything we want it to be, everything that maybe past jobs weren't or past jobs were that we want to carry forward. And so in my small sample size, we're really doing well. We're really jazzed. Things are hard. We're overwhelmed. You know, we're exhausted. We're cleaning all the time. All of those things are happening, of course. But we're finding ways to be together safely and just seeing the genuine joy that comes from that. And to do this new thing in our region in a way that's really meeting a need that we all saw. And so we are very enthused where we are in my small little team right there in my own school.
And Haley, you're in a more traditional setting.
Yes. It's been a hard year. It's been a really hard year. We've seen a lot more kids come in with that we didn't know about, who didn't come in through early access. And that might be because parents didn't reach out, or they weren't in those public settings where early access usually catches them, or they've just been home this whole time. And we have a lot of kids with more significant behaviors, and they're like not clearly caused by the pandemic, but you can sometimes see, oh, this is due to, they haven't had exposure to this. And that's been hard. We're trying to figure out how much to adjust what we're teaching to them and how much is like, if it's going to bounce back. So we're trying to navigate that right now, and we don't have the answers.
And I will just assure you, like, I mean, maybe somebody does, but I was going to say nobody has the answers to that, because I'm literally having the same conversations about our college students where we're saying, okay, we have this whole cohort that missed a year of field experiences. And now they're one semester out from student teaching, and they've never interacted with children live with us. Some of them also never worked with children. And how much do we, like, adjust our expectations, because you have to meet people where they are. There's nowhere else to meet them, right? You have to meet people where they are. But you can only get so far in a semester, and then we're going to turn you loose in student teaching. So we're feeling the same thing, Haley. Interestingly, the early interventionists that come visit my class were here today, and they said the same thing you just did, that statewide pre-K is having fewer kids come in that they were expecting to be on IEPs, and many more children that they're working to identify because kids were not in the same settings. They weren't going to the pediatrician. They weren't, you know, all of these things when we were more quarantining. Kara, I don't know if you've heard, but the pandemic is over in Iowa. I should clarify for anyone listening, it is not over. We are just treating COVID as if it is any other childhood illness. And so you will hear Haley and I refer to it in the past tense. Haley and I are both aware that it is not actually over.
For what it's worth, we've got a pretty similar situation here in Indiana where, yeah. No, I am completely on the same page as you with that. Yeah. Well, and I think too, that to your point, Haley, I just want to concur that that's actually very much what we're seeing in terms of kids who've come in who've never been around other kids or other than their family, who have always been home. And I mean, from something as mild as speech and language, and well, our family understands him perfectly fine. And so, well, okay, actually, this is maybe what we would be seeing, to just some of those interaction pieces. How do I wait my turn for something? How do I handle not being first or not being the best? Because that's a new thing that I have to deal with coming from me and my family unit for the past 2 years, where we've been kind of sheltered in, to now in this larger group. And so there's definitely a lot of that, those bumps and bumps in the road that everybody's trying to kind of figure out and how to navigate. That differentiation definitely seems much wider this year than in my previous experiences or in working with teachers in the past, where kids are coming in, some who had a pretty, not typical, nothing was typical last year, but who had a pre-K year that where they were attending a program in person most of the year, and others who may have been doing some homeschooling with their families, especially if they had older siblings, and others who were just kind of taking a year off and seeing what happened. And so it's just a really different experience prior to. And so that's really resulting in just some huge variations in terms of what we're seeing from kiddos.
And I think too, sometimes we forget this like collective trauma that we've also like all been through together. They're both nodding, for those of you that can't see them. Is nodding agreeing? Yes, nodding. And I think sometimes we forget that for learners, that they're carrying around, some of them are still carrying that around too, but you know, that changed what we tried to teach last year. I mean, I think Haley and I were having conversations last year, like we scraped down to the basics, you know, and now, so we actually didn't even try to get people as far last year. And I think Haley, you were like, we are focusing on social emotional, like that is where we are living this year. Cause if we're here and we're, you know, we're doing that, then that's great. So I think some of those things, I don't know why I started saying that, but I do think we're all still carrying around that stress level too. And so like frustration tolerance, at least with the college students, frustration tolerance is so low. And I don't know if you're seeing that with kids too, like everything else feels hard. And so not being able to get my shoes on is like the last straw.
Yeah. I mean, definitely big, just emotional response, big emotional reactions too. And I'm big on letting those emotions flow. And Christine, you know that about me from our experiences together, you know, feel those feelings and we'll figure out a way to navigate that. But yeah, that frustration tolerance, I think, is a really great way to word it, because that's the piece that does seem to be really low across the board, from families, from teachers, from children, just across the board. This it's one more thing, right? When this thing doesn't go the way I expect it to, whether it is that I can't get my shoe on, or this, you know, this change in a policy or procedure or whatever it might be. It's that one more thing that's just, oh, it's just too much sometimes.
I've noticed this year that we have a lot of kids who, we have them for 2 hours and 45 minutes. They hit that 2 hour mark. That's it. They're done. They're just done with everything. So I, over the summer, I was like, okay, I want to try this with my schedule this year, because I've only done like one other schedule. I want to try different stuff out. And yeah, I wasn't able to do that because I had to pretty much front load my day so we could get what they needed in the 2 hours. And then if we have time to do other stuff in those 45 minutes, great. I've got stuff ready. But if we just have to sit.
And I think, and Carrie, you could talk a little bit more about this, but I think that I'm thinking too, Haley, like we had a really cold day in Iowa, but I'm guessing you're spending more of that time outside too. I'm just like, okay, go run free. Like you're, that's what you need. And so, Kara, will you talk, you mentioned it, but will you talk a little bit more about what school looks like for you? And then, if you feel like that outside time is making a difference or just tell us more about that. It's super interesting.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I think there are actually a couple of pieces that we've got really going for us in our program right now that are helping to address some of these challenges or frustrations that are kind of cropping up. The first would be that we do have this really mixed age group kind of system going on all the way throughout the school. We are a pre-K through grade 8 program, and each of the classrooms is a mixed age group. And so we have that differentiation. And so I have some kindergartners who may be, you know, I hate to think of it as behind, just because, again, that's kind of what the last year did to us. But I've got some, you know, 5 and 6 year olds who might be at more of a 4-year-old level when it comes to one topic area, you know, maybe some of their math or their numeracy, but then they're right alongside some of their pre-K peers and getting to have those same experiences and build that foundation in whatever way meets their needs. And so we're able to individualize, differentiate depending on where they are. And then also see that same kid soar when it comes to some of those language skills or social emotional skills, you know, wherever their strengths are. So we've got the chance to see that piece happening. But yeah, we spend a lot of our day outdoors. And a lot of that time is out hiking in nature or out collecting things in nature to then take back and study. We spend time running and yep, go be free for a little bit and go be in this open space or go climb these trees over here and, you know, get that physical movement. And that really provides a lot of natural opportunities to practice those social emotional skills, that frustration tolerance. You know, we had a kid just earlier this week. Gosh, it's only Tuesday, just yesterday, who had climbed up into a tree and then was telling me, I can't get down. And it was just one of those great opportunities to talk about, wow, so what are you going to do? What's your plan? I noticed that when you climbed up, you kind of placed your feet here and you placed your hands here. What do you think you should try to figure out a way down? And immediately there are other kids coming over. Oh, I know what you should do. I have an idea. I climbed that tree before. And so we've got all these we can use the natural world where kids can spread out. They can be loud. They can do all those things that might be harder to do inside the four walls of the classroom. And we can find those moments to really dig deep and think about, what can we draw out of this? What can we, where can we push in a little bit? Where can we extend that challenge or scaffold them to that next step? And all the while they've got their peers around them to model something for them they've tried before, or to watch and think, gosh, I've never done that before, but maybe I will soon. Maybe I'll be ready soon. So I'm going to see how they do it. We spent a lot of our time outdoors. Today was a cold day, but we were still outdoors as much as we could get out there. And just being out in the world to have those experiences. I think that sensory input that comes from being in nature, whether it's feeling the wind on your face, hearing the rustle of the leaves, feeling the ground and the way the texture changes where you're walking, all of those pieces that are just naturally embedded into our air quotes classroom outdoors, really brings a lot of freedom for exploration for the kids and brings a lot of just soothing and calming opportunities there into the space as well. We don't have to fabricate a soothing, calming area. We've kind of got it in our backyard.
That's awesome. Haley, I'm going to ask this again, because I think we started talking about the kids and I get out of breath running up the stairs. But for you or for other teachers, and I know not just in your building, but you also stay in touch with your cohort from undergrad. What are you seeing as far as teacher burnout, or are teachers really doing okay and the media is blowing this up?
we're struggling. Like, I don't know how many coworkers or friends that I talk to who are teachers who we go home and we're like, we don't do anything. And I'm like, to the ones who have families, I'm like, oh my goodness. Like, I'm not at that point in my life yet. And I'm like, how? How are you making it happen? Because I go home and I lay there and I do nothing until I pull up my computer and work on stuff because it has to get done. And then I lay there some more and then I get up and I go to work again. And it's just constant. And it feels like there's no stop.
Yeah. Yeah. And just the layers of tiredness. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah.
Like, yeah, there's always going to be work, but it's like the mental tired and the physical tired.
The first few years of teaching are always hard. That you have done that during this pandemic is, it just makes me think that if you can get through one more year, then surely it will just be easier because you'll be like, that was the hardest 3 years I've ever taught. But yeah, I think it is just a uniquely draining time. And again, that buildup over the past year. Are you guys staffed okay? Or are you also in a like, don't take a day off position?
We're in a don't take a day off position, but our district was able to hire basically a sub associate who's always around. And we have a couple of our 3-year-old teachers who don't teach every day of the week, like the 4-year-olds do. So they're always like our backups if we need to take a day. But then we're also hearing from the district, take a day when you need a day. And well, when there's no one to cover my classroom, I'm not just gonna leave. So that's been interesting.
Yeah. And I do think there has to be, we have to, not you two, I'm not telling you two to do this. Those of us who are not in the trenches have to advocate for you that it is not fair to tell you, like, self-care is important, but also it's such gaslighting to be like, well, you need to do all these things for everybody and you need to make sure you're okay.
I think a hard piece too is that social emotional piece with all of that heightened emotionality, those heightened behaviors, plus the importance of then that rhythm, that consistent routine. I feel it's hard to step away even when there might be like, hey, do you need to just go take a breath for 15 minutes? I'm like, oh, but do you know what this particular child needs? Do you recognize that trigger? Do you recognize, you know, that sign that they're about to, you know, fall into a meltdown or really get frustrated? And if not, then it gets hard for me to leave in those moments too. And I think that speaks to some of that mental exhaustion that you spoke to, Haley, in that it's hard to turn it off because I feel like I'm so hypervigilant about what's going on with those children all the time, even when I'm at home and I'm thinking about the next day or what I saw that day or, you know, what that might lead to next. It gets harder to take a break, to have that self-care, to really separate, even when you want to or even when you are encouraged to.
I saw the suggestion last year, back when we thought we were going to revolutionize everything for teachers because teachers are heroes, that really the ideal school week would be 4 school days for kids and 5 paid work days for teachers. Mm-hmm. And I think there's something to that because like you're both saying, well, but if I'm not there when my kids are there, there's work before, there's work after, and there are things that are harder to step back into. Well, okay, I'm going to go a little bit bigger picture with a question, and then we can talk about whatever else you want. But, you know, there's huge spotlight on early childhood education right now from our current federal administration, strong emphasis on accessibility and quality, everybody's saying. What are your thoughts when you hear about this? And so it could be, and this is probably why Kara has a page, encouraged by, or what you're, I wrote weary, but I meant what you're leery of. So let me ask first, like, what are your thoughts? And then I'll come back and ask, you know, if they called you and said, what do we need to think about? So what are your big thoughts as you sort of hear about these ideas in the Build Back Better plan?
I have so many thoughts.
Seems that you would. Go ahead.
I will start by saying Okay. Gosh, I don't even know where to begin because it's so comprehensive. And I think that's the really challenging piece. We're not talking about, oh, if you just give funding, then that fixes this piece. Because then it comes to, where does that funding go that it's going to have the greatest impact? And what follows or supplements or goes along with that funding? So it's not just money in a pot, but also then the development and the skill set and the competency building and all of those pieces too. I think wages need to be addressed for the workforce. I think other retention strategies, whether it's related to benefits, to self-care, to community education, about the value of early childhood, all of those pieces are facets of this. And I will also say that I am leery of the lens of the conversation now, knowing that really, really great care and education happens in so many varied settings, whether it is a public school program, a family child care program, a licensed center, a registered ministry, whether it's happening with those infants and toddlers or those preschool and pre-K age children or those early elementary children, learning is happening, education is happening, phenomenal care is happening in so many different places that it gets tricky to think about, we will funnel funding toward these locales where learning takes place. Because great learning is happening in some location that's going to get left out. And I think that's a really challenging part of this. So I guess if I were thinking about, if somebody were calling me and saying, what should we do? My first response would be, you need to be checking in everywhere that children are to find out about what's working well, what the challenges are, and finding answers there. Because I think anywhere you look, any region, any family structure, and any care and education setting is going to have, there will be some universal needs, but there will also be some very complex needs, some very unique needs. And that gets really challenging to think through one like silver bullet, I guess.
And Haley, so you said that your school district already has a three-year-old. Is that just Part B services or?
It's through our community ed program. So it's a, they pay.
Oh, okay.
And if they are on that, they get to attend, I believe, for free if it's okay. A service that's being provided to them.
Okay.
We also have a two-year-old room, too.
You do?
Mm-hmm. There's, yeah. One two-year-old room, one full-time three-year-old room, and then there are two three-year-old rooms. And then there are a couple of rooms that do three-year-olds in the morning and four-year-olds in the afternoon.
I need to come visit you. I'm perplexed by the idea that you have a two-year-old room in an elementary school. Tell me it has bathrooms in it.
Yeah.
Okay, good. They're not walking down the hall.
We're our own little wing of an elementary building.
Kara knows of a classroom that I taught in with young threes that didn't have a bathroom in it, and it was terrible. Basic requirement for young three. So Haley, when you hear these ideas that, you know, people are really paying attention to and excited about or not, but, you know, about these ideas about universal pre-K and more funding, higher quality childcare, what do you have thoughts or reactions to that?
I haven't heard much about it because, like I said, I come home and I don't do much at all. But the one thing that makes me nervous is I have a feeling that if we get more funding into early childhood and it goes through the universal pre-K, they're going to up the expectation for these kids higher than it already is. And it's going to turn more into academic and it's not going to focus on the play and the social, emotional, all the skills that come from that. I can see that happening because right now I'm already like, we don't have enough time for them to just play, for them to just be 4 years old. And I think that the funding that might come is going to come with stipulations. And that makes me nervous.
And I think that's a piece that I think about too. Not that funding shouldn't come with accountability. Like, I'm okay with accountability, the concept outside of what we turned it into for education. But I think you're right, because if your three-year-old rooms all of a sudden are federally funded universal pre-K three rooms, do they all of a sudden have a set This is where I go on about Head Start and legislation and history and things I don't actually know enough about to be talking about. Folks who were not early childhood folks were saying, well, if we're going to put all this money into this program, then we need to be able to count, like, is it working or not? And I get it, right? Like, you want to know if it's working or not, so that you can make adjustments. But you're right. I think that makes you nervous that somebody looks at that and goes, oh, well, if by the end of their four-year-old year, they're supposed to know 10 letters, which I know isn't even, like, the expectation is much higher now. Then by the end of the three-year-old, they need to know 5 letters, or, you know, like, you start to have those conversations. And so I think you raise a valid point. If it's going to come with stipulations and it's going to come with accountability, then that also has to be appropriate, because just more hours, more instructional minutes for two-year-olds is a terrible idea if I'm not the one that gets to decide what instructional minutes mean, you know, like, what is an instructional minute for a two-year-old? Their whole life is instructional minutes. So yeah, I think that's a valid point.
Well, and I think too, that ties into, issues of, you know, equity and diversity and inclusion in terms of who's deciding what quality looks like, who's deciding what quality sounds like, and what is the lens through which they are looking at that? And do we have enough voices feeding into that to make it comprehensive, impactful for as many children as possible? And I think that all of that comes from hearing from as many voices as possible, and then making those, you know, those decisions from there. But that also costs money, right? Doing that really in-depth level of research to hear from as many people as possible also has a cost to it, and takes a lot of time. And so it makes it, again, just more complex in order to become that comprehensive piece it needs to be.
You're absolutely right. And from the couple of studies that I've worked on and done surveys with providers, either licensed centers or centers and home providers, and even some of our unregistered homes, they have less than 5 kids, they're not required to be registered. So they're legal, but they're not part of the state regulation system. The folks that we're not hearing from are likely the ones that are most overburdened, right? I mean, Haley has said it perfect. Like, I'm a second year teacher, I'm exhausted. Like, I don't want to answer I don't want to answer your survey because I'm tired and it's not mission critical right now. And so I'm busy trying to do all these other things. And so we did get some respondents who said, I'm open 24/7. Like, I provide for first responders. So whatever shifts they have for the week, that's when I'm open. And so thinking about those might not be people who can get away and come participate in our focus group. Or we were looking at, we were conducting a narrow cost analysis. It's incredibly important. It helps set the subsidy rates for childcare reimbursement in the state. I didn't say it was incredibly important, like, my work is important. The weight of what we did becomes increasingly apparent as I'm sitting in state meetings and people are sharing our data. And I'm like, okay, let's remember these things about this data. But it was a survey that if you didn't have your taxes done, if you don't do taxes and you didn't have your taxes done there, it would have been very difficult to answer. And a lot of the home providers who did answer, probably half of them said, well, I can't tell you a salary that I pay myself. Like, I pay my bills, I take care of my program, and I take care of my kids. Like, the idea that they would get a paycheck didn't even factor in, which is not to say that all of us wouldn't say, well, I pay my mortgage with my paycheck, but just that way of thinking is so different. And so I think a lot of those people that we need to hear from are also the ones that are already the most overtaxed. And so how do you ask for their input without adding to that burden is really challenging. The other thing I think about, and Kara has a history with infants and toddlers, so she may have had this thought too. So much of childcare's funding structure is based on preschool child fees subsidizing infant toddler classrooms, because of ratio and those sorts of things. And so we even saw in Iowa the impact of universal four-year-old pre-K, which is 2 hours and 45 minutes, Haley, is that what you said? So 2 hours and 45 minutes a day, 4 days a week in many districts. And even that had an impact. And we had programs that had to close because they couldn't keep their infant toddler room open because they didn't have the income from pre-K. And so I worry about that too, that what I keep hearing about it is the difference between universal pre-K for 3 and 4 year olds and subsidized childcare. And I think those have to be thought about holistically.
Well, and when you think about the structure of that family childcare, where that person is caring for that infant and that infant's older sibling who happens to be in the pre-K range, and maybe also after school caring for that first grader when they're coming off the bus, what are we doing to support that individual and that education program in their work with all of those different age groups? And then, you know, by doing so, supporting that family in being able to go to work and pursue their dreams, or go to school and pursue their dreams and know that their kids are in a safe place, learning things that they need to learn, learning things that they want to learn, and being cared for in a way that's appropriate.
Mm-hmm. I am convinced, especially for rural states, but probably true, you could probably make the same argument for urban centers. Family home childcare has to be attended to in this. When I think about there are towns in Iowa that are 500 people or less. And so thinking about even to say to a town, well, build a childcare center as a town and people will come. You may not have enough kids in your town to keep the center. And so that idea of supporting family home childcare in whatever it is they need. So do they have educational background, or they're just really great at kids, but they don't have business. Like, they didn't set out to be a small business owner, or are they actually like business savvy, but they could use support in how to do care and education. And so I think you're right too, that is a sector that has to be attended to.
Well, and I think it was really interesting that something that was not even surprising, I guess, it was something I didn't expect to see. And when I saw it, it was just, well, of course it happened that way. But during the pandemic, what we noticed, at least here in Indiana, was a lot of families making a shift to family childcare when they were ready to have that care happen again for their families, because it meant that their two kids of different ages could be with one teacher in one setting, and they didn't have to worry about as much exposure. When we think about pod care and things like that, and grouping of students within a program, that was a piece that felt like a natural fit. And so we had folks seeking out family childcare specifically because it meant that their kids could all be together under, you know, within this one program and with this one individual.
We had so many people tell us, like, you're so lucky. We would have ours back in care if we had your situation. So we're in a family home childcare. My 3.5-year-old has been with she's not at the moment, was there from 10 weeks old until 3 years old, and then started in a preschool childcare center. And then our son started there. He was born in April, like as the pandemic was becoming a tangible reality for us in Iowa. And started in October. And that was why there were two other families and us, you know, and our cautious provider and her pharmacist husband. Like, it was like, we felt as safe as we could feel. And so that's why I knew several people that were like, well, we're not back at childcare, but we would be if we were in your situation. So that doesn't surprise me. Oh my gosh, time is going fast. We have talked about a lot of the sort of heavy things. What makes you hopeful right now? As you're working with young children, as you're working with your colleagues, as you're thinking about early childhood, what makes you hopeful?
I mean, children themselves make me hopeful in terms of just their, you know, we talk about resilience, and I hate that anybody has to be resilient, especially a young child. But, you know, I think masks are a great example as we're thinking about COVID. My group of kids wear their mask, and that's just what you do. And they need lots of reminders, and yep, it fell down under your nose, and let's put it back up there and make sure it's fitting you. But they're not complaining about, why do I have to wear this, and this is uncomfortable. They're just doing it because that's just what they do at school. And we hear some of those complaints from adults, but I'm not hearing that from my students. And I think about the ways that they are coming back together and the ways they're talking in a very matter-of-fact way about COVID-19 and about getting vaccinated and about all of these different situations and all of that. It gives me hope to see that children are still children, right? That they're still exactly who they've always been, that they're still full of imagination and creativity and brilliant ideas. And all of that keeps going and keeps flourishing, and we get to keep supporting that. And on the flip side of that, the families themselves getting the chance to give them the reassurance that, yeah, your kid's doing fine. And yeah, these are some things that we're going to work on that maybe you didn't get a chance to work on last year because of everything. But everything's going to be okay, because I think a lot of that anxiety and that worry can be relieved. And it feels good to take that burden off their shoulders and to reassure them that, yeah, we're all behind. So there is no behind, right? Everybody's behind. So we all just are on the new, we're on a new playing field and we're all moving along together. But to see that shift, or even just that change in their expression from, gosh, I'm worried, is he okay? Gosh, he doesn't know this yet, she's not doing this yet. And to speak into, yeah, they're going to be okay. And let me talk about what they're doing and how they're progressing. And to see that ease come of, okay, yeah, they are going to be okay. My kids are going to be okay. I think for families, for teachers, for everyone, the children themselves are that hope.
What about you, Haley? And it doesn't have to be forced. If you're like, honestly, I'm too tired, like I need to borrow hope from other teachers, then that's okay.
I think Kara hit the nail on the head when she said it's the kids. Like, they're still kids. And that's the best part. They still come in like, well, what are we doing today? And our district recently switched, and now, so like we started the year where masks were optional, and then we went to a mask mandate, and now we're back to masks are optional. So the first few days when kids were wearing masks and some weren't, they're like, why are you wearing a mask? Because I don't want to get the COVID-19. And they're like, okay, my mom says I don't have to wear one anymore. And they're like, all right. And it's just so funny that that's all it takes for them. And then we're still seeing the growth. Like, it's still there. If I look back at where the kids were in August, it's December. I'm still not okay with that. I don't know how that happened, but to see where they are now, and thinking back where they were, they are growing. They are making progress, and they are loving what they're doing. And that's the things I focus on.
That's awesome. And I think I'm glad you both mentioned it. And I would say, one, like, tell your students that too, right? Like, not just their families, but like, remind them that they've grown. But I think that's really helpful encouragement. And even for me, is encouraging, because I think as a teacher, we've worked harder this year to see that and to empower that and to assure learners of like, you can do this. And like, you can, this is hard, but you can do it, and it's worth doing. And I have had several conversations last week where I've either said, like, I'm sorry you didn't get the best of me this semester, we didn't accomplish much. I said this to a poor PhD student. I was like, I'm sorry, this wasn't the experience it should have been. And she looked at me and I said, at the beginning of this semester, you didn't know what you're doing on your dissertation on, did you? And she said, no. And now I have research questions for it. Like, we did a lot. And she was like, I didn't have any idea what my topic was. And now I know exactly what I'm doing and I'm writing it up. And I was like, okay, never mind. Sorry, some learning happened. But I think, Haley, just like you said, like, it was August and now it's December and some things happened in the middle and I'm not even sure what they were. But sometimes it's hard to see that. And now I'm like, just finally starting to see some things click that I'm like, okay, we had to work really hard to get there this year, this semester, but we're getting there. So thank you both. That's a good reminder for me. Anything else you would say to either fellow teachers or especially new teachers that are like coming up on their first winter break, wrapping up their first semester?
It feels hypocritical now to go back and say self-care. But I will say that I think for me, finding what self-care looks like in the like pragmatism of the everyday workflow, you know, knowing that I can really find joy in a walk down the hill with this group of kids. And I don't have to in that moment be thinking about, do I have all the materials I need to have? Am I, you know, how are we starting this lesson? What does the intro to that look like? But just, yeah, check out that ice. Oh my gosh, that puddle that was here yesterday is frozen today. And what are we going to do about that? Let's stop and look at that. But that is self-care for me. And I remember working as a coach and working with a team of coaches. There was a coach who used to talk about, she called it the hand washing meditation. And it was just, I have to wash my hands. I have to wash my hands 1,000 times a day. So while I'm washing, I'm just going to focus on that. And I'm going to breathe deep And I'm going to take that 30 seconds that I'm rinsing or scrubbing and rinsing and drying and really just be present. And so those little snippets of time where you can really just be present and find peace, I think collecting as many of those throughout your daily routine as possible can help to ease some of that overwhelm. You're still going to be overwhelmed. You're still going to be tired. You're still going to think about teaching all the time. It's just the way that it seems to go in this career field. But yeah, if you can find those little moments of peace and start to practice those, I think that can make a really big difference.
And I think for me, I want to tell people that whatever you're doing, it's enough. It's making a difference. Even if you feel like you're not, like you didn't get this done, you didn't get this done. What did you get done? All of that matters. And it makes a difference. I remind myself of that constantly.
Well, and you, and not surprisingly, I think you're both very passionate and driven and motivated teachers. And so I could see how it'd be easy to always have the list of, but I should have also done this and I could have done this and I could, I mean, that's the thing about teaching, right? It's a fishbowl or it's a goldfish career. It'll take up as much space as you give it. You've reminded me of a couple things I've heard over the past year and a half, Kara, when Katie Norton, who's a kindergarten teacher, in a public school in Indiana, talked about she started doing a daily walk with her class. At the end of the day, she was like, they were squirrely and done and tired, and I was frustrated, and I like being outside, so we started going for walks. And she said it turned out to be a really meaningful part of their day, but that was a place she could build in self-care of, like, this is what I enjoy, and I'm going to share this with you. And so they did that. And then Stephanie Abramson, oh, I'm going to mess up her last name, and then she's going to listen to this, who last year was talking, I think, right around Thanksgiving break, said she makes herself stay the Friday before a break and leaves at least like the first lesson in the morning when they get back, whatever copy she needs, and a note to herself of what needs to be done. And then she leaves and she doesn't come back. She said the winter break is too short, and so I don't come back. She said over the summer I go in, you know, some early, but I take that time, as opposed to like busting out right after the class party. And she's like, I have to clean my room or it makes me, like, you know, she said, but she'll go so far as to write like the morning message for the first morning up so that she's ready to go. And so I think those are some of those things that it's like, it's going to be different for every teacher, right? But when you start to figure those things out for yourself of like, as long as my first 20 minutes is ready to go, I can cope. Or, you know, I know that I actually just need to like decompress and then I can do it. So I think it's fair to say self-care, but I like that you said everybody has to figure out what that is for themselves and how it fits in their routine. It can't be a 20-step. I don't know what beauty process it would be. Anyway, you both work in early childhood. Like you said, you wash your hands 1,000 times. Your nails, the paint would come off anyway. Well, thank you both so much. It's great to hear from both of you. I want to add that less than 24 hours after we had recorded this, I got a text from Kara. Another change had come and her school was going virtual for the remainder of 2021. And the timing, I think she was even reflecting back on the conversation and saying, okay, now I have to revisit overwhelm and how to make adjustments and meet the needs of all the kids. And so I think it was just a reminder of the flexibility and the resilience that teachers are living out constantly right now. So Haley and Kara, thank you so much for your time, and teachers, best wishes as you are making it through the final days before you get at least a short break. We love you. We are cheering you on from a distance. We hope the best for you and a winter break with peace and restoration and a wonderful, calm, uneventful new year.
Teachers in the Tiny Chairs is recorded, edited, and produced by Christine Lippard. Music by Jason Lippard. You can find us on Twitter and Instagram at The Tiny Chairs.